It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on his teachings, passing on the meaning of the teachings of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. A while ago, we were talking about ji and ri. Those are Japanese words. Ji being phenomena and things and thoughts, what we have in our mind. And ri being beyond thinking, beyond our understanding and perception. The lines of today's talk, each of the myriad things has its merit expressed according to function and place. Phenomena exist like box and lid joining. Principle accords like arrow points meeting. These lines refer to how the relative G and the absolute Re fit like a box and lid and a cord, like two arrow points meeting. And regarding the latter, Roshi tells this story of two archers. So in ancient China, Kisho, a very good archer, becomes ambitious and he wants to compete with, I think it's Hiei, a very famous archery master. So he waits with his bow and arrow for Hiei to come. I'm sure that's not the right, forgive me for that. And seeing Kisho, Hiei raises his bow and arrow and tries to hit Kisho first. But because they're both so good, their arrows met in the air, like tss. And so afterwards, they became like father and son. So we can also understand ji and ri coming together as the middle way. When there's ri, there's ji, and when there's ji, there's ri. And knowing this can help us to not reject our suffering, because both are always there and we can just know that. Indeed, Roshi says that suffering is a valuable thing and how we suffer will be our practice. How we suffer. Actually, if you think about it, the First Noble Truth, life is suffering, but so you could say that how we suffer is actually, since life is suffering, how we live. So how we suffer is actually how we live. And so this how is a very important ingredient. And Roshi tells the story of Bishop Yamada, who apparently led several sesshins at San Francisco Zen Center. And he practiced something called unshu, U-N-S-H-U, another Japanese word. But this is a kind of neat tool for you all to have, and I want to share it with you. I think his teacher, Hakuin Zenji, a very famous Zen master, had practiced unshu for a long time. And it means, and Hakuin had consumption when he was young, and he conquered his illness by this practice, which means putting the emphasis on the out-breath. And Roshi gives an example, and I don't know whether you'll hear this or even if this is correct, but it's like, It's like that. So Roshi, when he's giving this, he wants to share this with his students. He says, how do you say that? And some student says, groan. And he says, groan? No, when you suffer, you should say, like, and a student says, sigh? No, not a sigh. Moan? No. It should be like a tiger in pain, Roshi says. So growl? No. And Roshi laughs. No, not growl. Hakuin says your breathing should be like breathing when you suffer. And you should put your strength in your lower abdomen and take a long time exhaling. So, and also with Unshu, you need to do all of this silently. So otherwise it's not Unshu. So everything I'm describing, for it to be this healing factor tool that you can use when you're suffering, it needs to be done silently. But you can use it when you're suffering either physically or mentally. And Roshi says it can be just like Shikantaza. It's a very important practice. So I want us to try it for a second. Imagine you suffering, which may not be too hard, and breathing from your exhaling from your lower abdomen. First, forget silent. Let's just do it. Exhaling from your lower abdomen like a tiger in pain, really deeply, like, like that, I think. And then try it silently so you get the feeling in your body of creating that sound only without the sound. Like. Like that. Roshi says when your suffering is centered in your chest and your breathing is shallow, that's agony. But when you suffer, you should suffer completely. You should completely suffer and suffer from your lower abdomen with this expression. And he says, when you do that, you'll feel good, actually. It's much better than saying nothing or just lying down. And he gives an example of Bishop Yamada, who apparently, when he was in Los Angeles, he's dead now, but when he was in Los Angeles, he suffered a lot. And at that time, Roshi says, he himself hadn't had much illness and he couldn't understand. He didn't understand this Unshu practice. And so, but he says he found out and that he found out that it helps a lot. And since our human destiny is to have some suffering, how we suffer is really the point. And to know how to suffer completely, but we should not be caught by it. And I think Roshi was really terrific at suffering and not being caught by it. He was a terrific model for not being caught by it. Because and coming from Roshi, actually proposing that we learn this Unshu practice means a lot, because as you know, he suffered a lot. I gave you an example a few weeks ago of emotional suffering, but he also died of liver cancer and he never took painkillers or did any of the things that most of us do when we have cancer. I'm sure he practiced Unshu a lot, and he also allowed himself to enter into the suffering a lot. The other day, I was reading a sutra, which is, by the way, a talk by the Buddha, memorized and then written down, and then we have a sutra. So anytime the Buddha just happened to give a little talk on something he noticed around the monastery or whatever the talk was, when Shakyamuni Buddha was alive, his assistant Ananda, who had a perfect memory, memorized it and then gave the talk again the next day. And then some centuries later, these talks were recorded. They were passed on orally for a very long time. But anyway, so the other day I was reading a sutra, which begins by describing the manifold audience that was present to hear this sutra. And by the way, this one was given by the cosmic Buddha, not Shakyamuni. So several centuries after Shakyamuni, the cosmic Buddha gave it was really like a gathering of millions of beings around the Tathagata, the enlightened one. So the sutra begins by enumerating all these beings and ending with humans and non-humans. And what are non-humans? Ghosts. And what are ghosts? Ghosts, Reb Anderson Roshi explains, are beings that dependently co-arise when there's an experience that we don't fully embody, like maybe our suffering, for example. Reb Anderson Roshi says, it doesn't happen every single time, but when something powerful takes place and we don't fully experience it, that can be a condition for the arising of a ghost of that experience. So if you do a period of meditation, for example, and you don't practice wholeheartedly, it gives rise to a kind of ghostly specter of an unlived period of meditation. In that sense, we are haunted by history and by the history of the moments that we haven't lived fully. A Buddha's assembly welcomes all these ghosts who represent all our unfulfilled experience and our unfulfilled life. They are welcome to come and receive the Dharma so they can be fulfilled and released. This is what Reb tells us. I think we can all relate to this. Avoidance could be the first place we go when we're faced with pain or suffering. And I personally find this image of a dependently co-arisen ghost that fills in for us in our absence very profound. Actually, I'm free associating at this moment. So in my last banjo lesson, there was a piece that I wasn't enthralled with working on. And I was expecting my teacher to say, "Oh, honey, why don't you just shelve it for now?" But instead he said, "Why don't you inhabit it and make it three-dimensional?" Which was essentially saying, get rid of your ghost and be present for this piece, which is perfectly fine piece. I just give you that example, which just happened last week, because it's probably one of many that happened last week and other times where there's a ghost of an experience of unfulfilled moments. So to find the oneness of G and Re, the oneness of joy and suffering, the oneness of joy, the joy of enlightenment within difficulty is our practice, Roshi says. And this is called the middle way. When there's suffering, there's the joy of suffering or nirvana. But even in nirvana, you can't get rid of suffering. We say nirvana is the complete extinction of desires. But what that means is to have complete understanding and to live according to it. And this is Zazen. You're sitting upright. You're not leaning over to the side of nirvana or leaning over to the side of suffering. You're right here. And everyone can sit up and practice Zazen. Regarding Zazen, don't forget, these talks on the Sandokai were given during a summer sesshin in 1970. And this would maybe, this talk particularly would be maybe the fifth day, and everyone was losing energy. And in the morning, while everyone was sitting, Roshi gave a pep talk. He gave a pep talk. And I want to read this to you because I know a lot of you are sitting perhaps for the first time and perhaps without formal Zazen instruction. And his words, Roshi's words, are how to sit without your ghost being there. And to do it, even though this might go beyond what you can do, he sets a really high bar. This isn't like a beginning Zazen instruction. But still, when I heard it, when I was sitting there listening, I was exhausted, but I was very inspired, super inspired, even though I couldn't do any of it. So, even though I couldn't do any of it, my body took it in. And this is not only about how to do Zazen, but how to live moment by moment. So I just want to remind you that practice and enlightenment, Roshi constantly says, are the same when we are practicing. It's the same as enlightenment. And so however you are doing Zazen, you're practicing, you're the best you can. And there is no Zazen Olympics. It's not about Zazen Olympics. As you're listening to this pep talk, if you want to, you could get into your Zazen posture. Maybe you'll feel this better. So now this is Roshi talking during sesshin to exhausted students. You should sit with your whole body, your spine, mouth, toes, mudra. Mudra is the position of your hands, which form a circle called the cosmic mudra. Check on your posture during Zazen. Each part of your body should practice Zazen independently or separately. Your toes should practice Zazen independently, and your mudra should practice Zazen independently, and your spine and your mouth should practice Zazen independently. You should feel each part of your body doing Zazen independently. Each part of your body should participate completely in Zazen. Check to see that each part of your body is doing Zazen independently. And this is also known as Shikantaza, which is just sitting. To think I am doing Zazen or my body is doing Zazen is wrong understanding It is a self-centered idea. The mudra is especially important. You should not feel as if you are resting your mudra on the heels of your foot for your own convenience. Your mudra should be placed in its own position. Don't move your legs for your own convenience. Your legs are practicing their own zazen independently and are completely involved in their own pain. They are doing zazen through pain. You should allow them to practice their own zazen. If you think you are practicing zazen, you are involved in a selfish, egotistical idea. If you think that you have a difficulty in some part of your body, then the rest of the body should help the part that's in difficulty. You are not having difficulty with some part of your body, but the part of the body is having difficulty. For example, your mudra is having difficulty. Your whole body should help your mudra do zazen. The entire universe is doing zazen in the same way that your body is doing zazen. When all parts of your body are practicing zazen, then that is how the whole universe practices zazen. Each mountain is standing and each river is flowing independently. All parts of the universe are participating in their practice. The mountain practices independently. The river practices independently. Thus, the whole universe practices independently. When you see something, you may think you are watching something outside of yourself, but actually, you are watching your mudra or your toe. That is why zazen represents the whole universe. We should do zazen with this feeling in our practice. You should not say, "I practice zazen with my body." It is not so. Dogen Zenji says, "Water does not flow, but the bridge flows." You may say that your mind is practicing zazen and ignore the practice of your body. Sometimes, when you think that you are doing zazen with an imperturbable mind, you ignore the body, but it is also necessary to have the opposite understanding at the same time. Your body is practicing zazen in imperturbability while your mind is moving. Your legs are practicing zazen with pain. Water is practicing zazen with movement. Yet the water is still while flowing, because flowing is its stillness or its nature. I'm going to read that one again. Water is practicing zazen with movement, yet the water is still while flowing, because flowing is its stillness or its nature. The bridge is doing zazen without moving. Let the water flow, as this is the water's practice. Let the bridge stay and sit there, because that is the actual practice of the bridge. The bridge is practicing zazen. Painful legs are practicing zazen. Imperturbably, zazen is practicing zazen. This is our practice. That's the end of that talk. I even think sometimes that this talk is giving this talk, because it feels like that sometimes, actually. So, you know, in Zen, everything relates to everything else. And that's why the details of our posture are so important. But this interdependency plays out outside of Zazen also, in our everyday lives and also in the Dharma, as the Dharma is written, the words themselves follow this procedure. Each word and each sentence contains its previous word and sentence and its following word and sentence, so that the Dharma itself exemplifies the interdependent nature of reality. This is true of the precepts also. Each one contains all the others, and also the six paramitas, the perfections, which are generosity and ethics and patience and joyful energy, exuberance, and concentration and wisdom. Those are the six paramitas. And here too, each one contains all of the other ones. So when you sit, Roshi's saying, your toe will be doing full-on Zazen along with, independently and with the whole universe. And this is Ji and Ri, and this is how Zen works. So here are the five most important points from today's talk. The first is suffering is a valuable thing. How we suffer will be our practice. Suffering is a valuable thing. How we suffer will be our practice. Secondly, when you suffer, remember the practice of Unshu, which means putting emphasis on the out-breath, like a tiger in pain, only silently. And when you suffer completely, you should suffer with your lower abdomen, and you should feel good when you do that. Roshi says it's much better than saying nothing or lying down. Thirdly, ghosts are beings that dependently co-arise when there's an experience that we don't fully live. Ghosts dependently co-arise when there's an experience that we don't fully live. The fourth point is that when we say nirvana is the complete extinction of desires, what that implies is to follow the middle way. When there's G, there's Re, and when there's Re, there's G. And remembering that both are there, suffering and enlightenment, the relative and the absolute, that is practicing the middle way of Mahayana Buddhism. That's the fourth point. And the fifth point is to remember that you are not practicing Zazen. Zazen practices Zazen. And that is our practice. And so here are five things for you to think about or maybe write about during the week. And the first one, so here's an idea. Why don't you make a little community out of all your ghosts, your unlived moments, when your ghost dependently co-arise alongside you and live your moment instead of you? So gather them all together. See if you can remember and see if they can talk together and make sense out of things. And the groups are patterns of them, you know, some of them are going to be over here and some of them are going to be over here. They're going to be in little, you know, cohorts of themselves. And you might be able, by identifying them, to see your life more clearly. Like, oh, when I do X, it's my ghost suit. All my ghosts do that. I don't do that actually ever. But when I do this, you know, I'm full on doing this. And so you start recognizing, or even you can anticipate. So this is one of those upcoming times when I already know I check out. And so you can like be careful. So the first idea is make a little community out of all your ghosts. And secondly, try to practice Unshu aloud and silently. Just get it down so that when you need it, you know, we have it from a really good source that it helps. I think Roshi got through his cancer with this practice. It's just my belief that he did that, since he's talking about it. So get that in your toolkit. And thirdly, Roshi insists that it's how we suffer that is our practice, which really means how we live, since life is suffering. So how do you suffer? What would you say is your suffering style? Think about that. Right now, like before you do anything, what's your present suffering style? What do you do? And fourthly, Kisho and Hiei, the archers, practice their art as if their life depended on it. I mean, when an archer as good as Hiei shoots an arrow at Kisho, you know, Kisho's very likely to die. So what did you feel when you listened to that story? And what is there for you to learn in it? What can you learn from that story? And lastly, the fifth thing to think about is, how do you reconcile Roshi's detailed description of Zazen with you when you do Zazen? How do you reconcile that? And it's not, well, just skip Zazen. It's not that. There isn't a Zazen Olympic. We're not about Olympics here. We're about you doing Zazen, or Zazen doing Zazen. Okay. Well, there was a lot today, and I wonder if there are questions.
Gail, the first question that we have is there any point to distinguish the difference between suffering and pain? If so, what is the difference?
I don't think there is a difference. I think that pain is the physical experience, the experience we have in our body. Our body feels pain when we're suffering. I'm trying to think, even when we're emotionally suffering, our body feels pain. and somehow that lower abdomen exhale, deep, has to be deep and focused on the suffering or pain that you're feeling. Keep that absolutely in mind, like you're targeting that as you do that lower abdomen exhale. You'll get them both. I just think that pain is the way our body experiences suffering. That's all.
Gail, the second question is, ghosts are being that dependently co-arise when there's an experience that we don't fully live. I have a lot of trauma in my past. Sometimes it feels that most of my life was inhibited by ghosts. Is there a connection between trauma and having a lot of unlived life?
It really makes sense to me. When one re-experiences one's trauma, it acts like a trigger that shuts down your frontal lobes. And so there's a lot more that happens also, but even if it were just this, you would not be able to be fully present. And I certainly know this personally. But again, throw a party for all your unlived moments. And see who congregates by that table and that table. I think there's a whole lot to learn. And I think that trauma and unlived moments go together. They'll be at the same table. That's all.
The next question is, the Sandokai seems to be saying that all beings have their own virtue or merit, each thing according to its own nature. Human nature isn't all that admirable. What do we do about that?
Human beings, I think because we're selfish and egotistical and ignorant of the truth, especially need to do, we need to follow the precepts, and which we'll talk about soon, and live according to the paramitas, the perfections, and those things actually cleanse, purify the place where all of this lives in our psyche. It lives in a part of our consciousness called the Alaya, the storehouse consciousness. And that consciousness can be purified. This stuff that we human beings suffer, greed, hate, and delusion, zazen and precepts and living fully in each moment goes a long way to help. That's what we can do about it.
So the next question is that when Roshi says to find the oneness of Re and G, the oneness of joy and suffering, the oneness of joy of enlightenment within difficulty is our practice. Can you say a little more about this middle way?
Even though our ways of expressing our natures are different, our natures have the same basis. And so that's the application of the truth. And this is what Sakito is actually talking about. We shouldn't be attached to the difference in usage, because we are using the same basis, Buddha nature. According to the situation, we'll use Buddha nature in different ways, and that's how to find the true nature in our everyday lives. Is that clear? We have the same basis, and so the distinctions resolve into the same basis always. And so that's all we did. That's all we need to remember. The absolute and the relative are the same, are one.
Thank you, Gail. The next question is, I feel a little intimidated by Roshi's description of Zazen. If I feel I can't do any of it, why should I try?
I know. This is where practice and enlightenment being the same thing comes in. You know, if you're at a concert and you hear a viola player who's just marvelous and so inspires you, and you decide you're going to try to play the viola, you wouldn't say, well, I'll never play like her, so why bother? You say, I'm going to do my best, and even a little bit will be wonderful. And the effort itself, if you make a practice out of it, which it's easy to do with music, you just practice your viola, it's as worthwhile as mastery. And so just completely inhabit whatever you do, whatever you decide to do, completely inhabit it, so that then you fall away, you disappear. You don't need to be. Roshi's description was really a description of how to fully inhabit your body as your body is doing, your body and mind as your body and mind participate in allowing Zazen to do Zazen. That's all.
Next one is, other forms of meditation don't seem so rigid. I find Zen very compelling, but Zazen, it's hard.
Putting yourself in the posture of the Buddha provides your body and mind complex with a lot of information. It goes a long way in helping you become nothing. And we need to become nothing, because our biggest problem all the great ones say the same thing. Our biggest problem is thinking that we have a separate, independent, individual existence. And Zazen does not feed that untruth. The posture itself suggests the opposite, even if we're unaware of it. What I want to stress, because I know that the pep talk of Roshi gave a pretty high bar. Just take it in, that's all. Just take it in. Take it in and let your body do with it what it can. The thing that we're mainly doing is, as a human being, taking the posture of the Buddha, who did attained enlightenment, and along with all of us, along with all of us. That's the teaching of Mahayana Buddhism. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. That was the last question.
Thank you very much. That's all then for today.
Gail, are you here?
Yes.
So we got another question just now, and we have time. So is it okay?
Sure.
Okay. So the question is, you said in answer to another question that when you fully inhibit a situation, then you drop away. I'm struggling to understand the ghosts that were also referred to. Are we the ghosts when we are not fully present? And when we are present, then we are Buddha?
The way it was put by Reb Anderson Roshi was that the ghosts dependently co-arise with us when we are not fully inhabiting our moment. So it's almost like the ghost whips in when there's a space of lack of full concentration. That's how I'm kind of metabolizing this. And so when you completely inhabit your moment, there's no space left. There's no space, and there's no space even for you. There's just the moment. And so then that's your nothingness. I don't know how to explain it better than that. But the ghost dependently co-arises alongside you. That's how Reb describes it.
And the last question that we have is, what would you say is your suffering style like?
My own suffering style? Is that what you said?
Yes. So yeah, that's the question.
Well, I didn't know about Unshu before recently. And I think I would do that. I think now, I turn to the things that comfort me, actually. Reading comforts me. Um, Zazen comforts me, actually. I turn to the things that comfort me. But, you know, that's not the best. Don't take that as a model. The best is realizing that Ji and Ri both exist. And so suffering is life itself. And in Buddhism, it's thought that, you know, we ourselves laid down the causes of that suffering in previous lifetimes. And the best we can do now is to lay down the causes for less of that in future lifetimes. But I ask you, what you do, what is your style? And I hope it's better than my style. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. Yes, that was the last question.
All right, then. Bye-bye.